obesity,
sexual health,
diabetes,
supporting men's health and patient care,
building knowledge in men's health communities.
Welcome back to the Men's Health Podcast. Today, we'll be talking about a unique genetic condition called Klinefelter syndrome. Klinefelter syndrome is an underdiagnosed and, fair to say, misunderstood health condition across the healthcare professional community and the general public. It's estimated that only 25% of the expected number of Klinefelter patients are actually diagnosed, and only a minority of these are diagnosed before puberty. So, Klinefelter affects approximately 1 in every 660 men, and is one of the most common chromosomal disorders. But in today's episode, we'll be learning all about Klinefelter syndrome to help raise awareness and improve the diagnosis and care of Klinefelter patients. And we've got the best person on board to help, because we're joined by a researcher, advanced clinical practitioner, a lecturer, and Klinefelter patient himself, Chris Breen.
Yeah, so my name is Chris Breen. Professionally, I'm a nurse and a paramedic, and I currently work for the University of Lincoln, so I run some degree program there and teach on a variety of courses. I'm also a trustee of the Klinefelter Syndrome Association, which is probably more relevant to today's talk.
Thank you. And as we'll get on to later on, you're a researcher and lecturer in Klinefelter syndrome, but you're also a patient yourself. So could you share a bit more about this journey and how it actually led to you working within the field?
Yeah, so about 8 or 9 years ago now, I actually found out I had Klinefelter's myself. And I looked around on the internet because I'd never, despite working in healthcare for 20 odd years, I'd never even heard of it. You know, I had no idea what it was. I looked around on the internet, found the organization, the support organization. First of all, joined them as a professional member because they... Honestly, they had free membership if you were a nurse or a doctor. So I joined them just to get some more information. Later on, when I thought about doing some research, I contacted them. And they said, well, if you're going to do some research, we'd prefer if you're a full member and become more involved and meet our membership. And I thought that was a great idea. So I became a volunteer with them. I started running their social media for them because they didn't have anybody else with that skill set. And since then, I've become a trustee as well. So I do a lot of things as a trustee.
That's great. So let's jump right in then to Klinefelter syndrome. I think it's fair to say a lot of people have probably never heard of this condition before, including healthcare professionals. So could you tell us what Klinefelter syndrome is?
So it originates from a genetic difference. So whereas women generally have XX chromosomes and men generally have XY chromosomes, people with Klinefelter's have XXY. So you could say they have both sets. So they have some characteristics of both genders. This causes hypogonism. And I know you've had a previous talk on, a very good talk on hypogonism. So if people want to look back at that one. And so some of the symptoms are caused by the fact that people's testes don't work very well. And some of the symptoms are caused by other genetic changes, which are caused by the different carrier type.
As Chris mentioned, Klinefelter syndrome is a genetic chromosomal condition. Chromosomes are like X-shaped structures made from sections of DNA. In humans, we typically have 46 chromosomes arranged in 23 pairs. Each pair contains one chromosome from each parent, 23 from the mother and 23 from the father. The 23rd pair is critical to determine the sex of the individual. Females have 2X chromosomes, while males have 1X and 1Y. Now, when things deviate from this usual arrangement, we encounter conditions like Klinefelter syndrome. Klinefelter syndrome occurs when a male inherits an extra X chromosome, resulting in the 23rd pair being XXY instead of XY. This genetic mismatch leads to Klinefelter syndrome and the various clinical manifestations that result, including hypogonadism, which is a clinical deficiency of testosterone with the presenting symptoms and features. Okay, and how common is Klinefelter syndrome? Because people think it's a very rare condition, but it's probably a bit more common than we may think.
Yeah, so it depends which paper you read, but we've had estimates as low as 1 in 300 people assigned male in birth to 1 in about 650. So the common figure for many years said there was one in 650, but we think it's slightly more common than that now. But how common, we're not sure. So a lot of this research was based on small sets of people, so it's difficult to generalize into the population. It's one of a number of what they term intersex conditions, and they reckon intersex conditions make up something like 1.7% of the population, and probably Klinefelter's, because it's relatively common, is a large percentage of those. As to being a rare condition, it's included in the rare endocrine conditions category. However, it's mainly rare by the fact is people rarely pick it up. So we reckon there's a lot of people that are, living relatively normal lives that have XXY chromosomes, but have no idea. So it's rare by the fact it's rarely diagnosed.
Okay, and with Klinefelter syndrome being not a well-recognized condition, do you think there are lots of men and boys out there who are walking around with Klinefelter syndrome who don't know they actually have it? There are some figures to suggest that only 25% of the expected number of Klinefelter patients are actually diagnosed. And most of these are post-pubertal males, despite it being a genetic or congenital condition.
Yes, quite possibly. A lot of people get diagnosed sort of in early adulthood when they try for children, because most people that have Klinefelter's are infertile. So some people, if they're caught as children, sometimes they can harvest sperm and things from them, and therefore they can, by assisted fertilization, have children. But the majority of us are infertile. So often that's a point of diagnosis. So some people are picked up prenatally, but normally people are only tested prenatally if there's a reason to believe that they might have a genetic difference. And that's generally people whose parents, there's either a family history of genetic differences, or they're older parents, and therefore they advise them to get tested, because you're more likely to get sort of a genetic abnormality if you have older parents. Some people do opt for tests on children. There's one called NIPT, but that isn't widely available at the moment.
Great. And it will be very useful to understand in more detail what the specific symptoms of Klinefelter syndrome are. Obviously, we get lots of men and healthcare professionals who listen to this podcast, and we've discussed how Klinefelter is a relatively underdiagnosed and misunderstood condition. So I think it'd be really valuable to learn more about the common symptoms associated with Klinefelter and what men and healthcare professionals should be looking out for.
Yeah, absolutely. So the primary symptom, which you'll see in most people, is people have very small testes. The problem is, particularly people assigned male at birth, generally, guys are very reluctant to go to the doctors for anything, and they're very reluctant to show people their bits, particularly if they're a bit embarrassed about them. So this is why we reckon there's lots of people that have never presented, because either they realise or don't realise there's something different about them, but are very reluctant to tell anybody. Because of the hypogonadism and the low testosterone, some people have erectile dysfunction. So some people might go to the GP saying, I'm having trouble with my sex life. Can you, help me? And sometimes the GP would just give them something like Viagra or one of the other medications and send them on their way. But it'd be nice if they actually did a physical examination. Because if then it's pretty obvious if you examine somebody that their testes would be quite small. So some people, because their testes are quite small, they don't really have a scrotum. So it's very obvious. And some people will have a scrotum, but if they did a physical examination, they would see. So that's the cardinal symptom, certainly. There's lots of other things that go on. So people with, generally people are quite tall. So I'm just under 6 foot, which isn't particularly tall nowadays. But I'm originally from South Wales, and in 60 years ago when I was growing up, people were generally quite on the short side. So throughout my school years, I was one of the, in junior school, I was the tallest person by a long way. And in secondary school, I was probably in the top five people all the way through school, because people were generally shorter. So if you're tall compared to your peers, that's a way that be picked up as well. There's also some conditions that we're more prone to. So if somebody presents with anemia, so anemia is much more common in women, but less common in men. So if you have anemia without an apparent cause, like an idiopathic anemia, then that's something that might be an indication. And we're also more prone to osteoporosis. One of the things I found out is after I had my diagnosis is I'm sort of fluctuating between osteopenia and osteoporosis in my spine and my hips. But the way I look at it is just a number on a piece of paper because I've never actually broken any big bones in my life. So I'm not overly worried about that one. But some people, you know, it's a spectrum disorder and some people are much more affected. So those are sort of adult stuff. With kids as well, sometimes there's developmental delays. Particularly around sort of speech development and language skills. Some young children have hypertonia, so they have poor muscle tone and therefore sometimes have delayed walking or crawling. Some of them have sort of undescended testes. There's all testicular stuff going on there and sort of delays in general. So other sort of general symptoms as well is something like 80% of children might have some sort of, you know, across the genders might have some sort of breast development, but a lot of it goes away as they get older. But with people with Klinefelter's, they often retain breast tissue. So I've got little boobs. So not bothered. Other things, there's lots of neurodiversity. So some people have learning disabilities as well. I'm dyslexic, but I didn't find out until I was 40. So it didn't have a huge effect on my life because it wasn't particularly severe, but some people are more affected by it. But because it's a spectrum condition, you know, some people have very, you know, people tell me that I'm... you know, I don't have a lot of problems with the Klinefelter's, but I actually have lots of the features, but they don't massively interfere with my life. So, you know, I just crack on with it. Another thing is cardiac problems as well. So some people have various cardiac abnormalities, sometimes to do with the valves, sometimes to do with the conduction. So personally, I've got quite a slow heartbeat. So, which people are thinking of, I have the heartbeat of an Olympic athlete, but unfortunately not the body to match. Because of the low testosterone levels as well, people generally are quite slim. They might have sort of visceral fat, but they'll have skinny arms and legs. So tall, stick insect-like with, you know, these other potential features.
Yeah, thank you. And a lot of different symptoms are associated with Klinefelter syndrome. And as you mentioned, this is such a tricky scenario for kind of healthcare professionals. Of course, GPs and nurses aren't expected to know and understand every single health condition. But one of the issues, I think, is that some of the symptoms associated with Klinefelter syndrome, such as anemia or erectile dysfunction, they're a sign for many other health conditions. And the first stage should not be to immediately deliver treatment, but instead conduct a further diagnosis, as you know, the erectile dysfunction could, for example, simply be hypogonadism, or it could be a patient who has Klinefelter syndrome. So it's often a case of not necessarily immediately treating the symptom, but actually conducting a further analysis to understand what is happening here. And this might help many patients avoid that delay in diagnosis and ultimately help patients be diagnosed correctly and receive the right treatment from the first presentation of those symptoms, rather than go through a very long trial and error approach with different treatment options without actually understanding the underlying cause.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I've heard of people who have had a similar journey of being given various different types of medicine to help them with a sex life. And then when none of it helped, then we're sent to a urologist. And the urologist did the examination and then thought, you know, obviously there's something going on here. But that was like a massively delayed diagnosis because, you know, they could have been picked up in primary care.
And are there easy karyotyping tests available for patients?
So there's karyotyping, and that's how people find out. Simple blood test, you know, takes a couple of days to come back. And, you know, then you get a definite answer. So most people have complete XXY, and some people have mosaic XXY. So they only actually test, I think, like 30 cells or something when they do it, or 30 genes. But they presume from that, if all 30 of them are XXY, they presume it all XXY. And if some of them aren't, then they presume you're mosaic. So mosaicism in XXY is much rarer, we believe, and people that are mosaic have less symptoms. So they might be fertile, but they'll have less hypogonism, and the other symptoms don't affect them as much.
Great. And when are people commonly diagnosed with Klinefelter? Because you mentioned some of the symptoms that occur during childhood, and it could be, for example, abnormal growth or kind of body shapes. But there are many kids out there who may just have that because that's who they are, and it's not necessarily a sign of a kind of a clinical manifestation. And even if it is something which is maybe kind of clinically abnormal, a lot of parents might just think, "Oh, that's just who my kid is," and you know, he'll go through puberty and follow the typical kind of growth and development pathway. So it could be quite challenging for parents to actually recognize there's maybe something underlying going on here.
Yeah, absolutely. And this is why we have such a low diagnosis rate, because a lot of the symptoms can, you know, they could just be isolated symptoms on their own. There might be some sort of isolated neurodiversity, which is causing delays. But it's, you know, it's also, we have to think about puberty as well, because a lot of people go through don't go through a full puberty. So my parents, I've got two older siblings who are a lot older than me, because my parents were quite old when they had me, and they were they're very high achievers, and, you know, whereas I struggled in school, but I've done quite well in life, got a good career, but it's just taken me a lot more effort. But as a teenager, they said I was an angel compared to my brother and sister. But that's because I didn't have a complete puberty. So, you know, I didn't have all those teenage angst and like hyper testosterone going around the place. I just sort of sailed through it. So,
yeah. And I guess you mentioned some of the more kind of highly specific symptoms, such as kind of very small testes and scrotum. So if the parents do have any concerns with their children's development, one, this should be enough to kind of visit a healthcare professional in the first place. But a next step, I guess, for extra assurance is looking at the kind of testes and scrotum.
Yeah, and I think a lot of people that have children with development problems for whatever reason have trouble accessing services. And there's not a lot of services available. And that's the problem with people that are diagnosed young often have trouble getting support. So, you know, that's an issue in itself.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, as you mentioned before, the karyotype blood test is a very simple and inexpensive blood test, which doctors should really be performing to any patient who's presenting with some of the symptoms of Klinefelter. And unfortunately, sometimes the onus might be on the patient to actually demand this blood test. And we've talked a lot about what Klinefelter syndrome actually looks like in terms of its symptoms. But what is the prognosis and impact of Klinefelter syndrome on patients?
Okay, so the condition itself, because it's a syndrome, the syndrome just describes a load of, you know, symptoms and comorbidities. So itself is, you know, it's just a umbrella term. But the problem is it gives you a higher risk factor for a lot of different comorbidities. So I've already mentioned the osteoporosis. Diabetes is a big one, with something like three times more likely to get diabetes. Cardiac conditions I've mentioned already. With the diabetes, sometimes people have hypertension as well. And if you get hypertension, sort of peripheral vascular disease and diabetes, then you're at risk of developing metabolic syndrome.
Okay, so there's lots of different kind of considerations there, which we can dive into. And in terms of the management and treatment of Klinefelter syndrome, I'm sure we're going to talk about in a little bit more detail the role of testosterone in Klinefelter syndrome and therefore the importance of testosterone replacement therapy in actually correcting those hormone levels in the body, which can improve many of the symptoms associated with Klinefelter syndrome. But is it also important to look at preventative strategies or treatment options for some of the comorbidities that may develop as a result of Klinefelter syndrome, which you've discussed, such as osteoporosis or type 2 diabetes.
Okay, so you're right. So testosterone is the primary treatment, and they always recommend you have that one. One of the other sort of features, if you like, of a Klinefelter is that some people have gender incongruence, sit between the genders effectively. So in those cases, some people actually take estrogen. But because of the whole thing about gender identity services at the moment, it's virtually impossible to get estrogen as a primary source of treatment unless you go through the gender identity route. Another symptom I didn't mention is sort of fatigue, and people low testosterone often become very tired, have difficulty concentrating, and they also have some problems with executive function. So they have poor memory and sort of like brain fog and that type of thing. And if you have that's a lot to do. Some of it's neurodiversity and some of it's to do with low testosterone. But the two mixed together just, you know, gives people problems. So testosterone will often, you know, give people additional energy. And if they have that or whatever hormone they're taking, will give them that additional energy and then they'll be able to function better and therefore, you know, go out and do more exercise and therefore stave off some of the cardiovascular and diabetic routes as well. Some more informed endocrinologists who know about, you know, are specialists in sort of intersex DSD conditions will say, you know, I know somebody who's quite well known in the field, and they say sort of older people with Klinefelter should all be on metformin because they're going to be, you know, they're much more predisposed to having poor glycemia control and therefore more likely to become diabetic. So, you know, why aren't we starting them early? Things like the osteoporosis, then should we be measuring people's calcium levels, maybe giving them calcium supplements earlier as well.
You, of course, are a Klinefelter patient, so it would be good if you could share more about your own story with Klinefelter in terms of your diagnosis journey, maybe your treatment journey, and how Klinefelter has overall impacted your life.
Probably the reason I didn't find out until I was 50 was the fact I was married, got divorced 20 years ago. My wife was very career orientated. We didn't want kids. You know, it was never an issue. And everybody I've been out with since already had children and didn't want any more. So I never found out I was infertile. And that's probably the point of diagnosis. So I didn't find out until I was 50. And what actually happened was I had some pain, sort of testicular pain, went to the GP. He did examine me and thought I might have testicular cancer. So I was referred to the urologist, and I actually ended up having one of my testes removed. When they took it out, they said it wasn't cancerous, it was just atrophied or knackered in layman's terms. And the other one wasn't far behind. At that time, then they said, well, you know, there's obviously a reason this is going on. So we're going to test you for this condition, but we don't think you've got it because you don't fit the profile. And they sent off, did the genetic test and obviously came back positive and that was XXY. After finding out more about the condition after I was diagnosed, it explained my entire life. Because like I said, I barely had puberty. I've never been particularly athletic. I've got a bit of visceral fat, but I'm quite skinny, quite tall. I'm a bit neurodiverse. I found out I was dyslexic when I was in my 40s, and I've got all these additional health concerns. So I'm borderline osteoporosis. I've just found out I'm pre-diabetic, which I'm trying to lose some weight, stop getting any further. I've got some kidney problems, but it's not massive. The way I look at it is I'm nearly 60, and I could have a lot of these things in any case. But, you know, people who find out earlier in life is much more devastating for them. I haven't, when I found out from the urologist, I got referred to endocrinology, and this is before COVID. So the endocrinologist stuck me on testosterone. I was originally taking the injections, which you take every 12 weeks. But they really didn't agree with me because I was having like a massive dose of testosterone and it was sort of tailing off. So my testosterone levels were undulating massively. When they were very high, it almost changed my personality. It made me sort of quite confrontational. And I really didn't like myself from it, because it was like I was just having these waves of emotions, emotional stuff. But that was just me, and some people are absolutely fine on it. So COVID came along, my endocrinologist discharged me into the care of my GP, but didn't tell me he discharged me. My GP didn't seem to realise I'd been discharged, and so for 4 years I had no monitoring. So no blood tests, nothing. When as I was getting a bit older and I started getting more problems with various side effects, I actually approached my GP and said, look, I think I need my hormones monitored. And I wrote him a list and said, I want this done and I want a DEXA scan. And if I hadn't been a healthcare professional, I wouldn't have known all that. Other people would have just gone on and waited for somebody to call them and, might not have ever had that call.
Wow. I mean, what a journey. And that really highlights, I guess, many of the issues we have in the healthcare system, that it took so long for you to actually receive your final diagnosis. And I imagine there are many other people out there who have had similar experiences to you.
Some of my colleagues who have Klinefelters in the association and things have had much more difficulties with life than I have. So some people have had a very rough journey for diagnosis and have been missed many times. They've had many more opportunities where they've realised that something is wrong, and they've gone to a healthcare professional and it hasn't been picked up.
Yeah, and it's interesting, you mentioned when you were initially initiated on testosterone replacement therapy, you were put on an injection, and absolutely right that there are many injectable testosterone preparations out there that do cause what we call a supraphysiological or an excessive testosterone response. And excess testosterone levels above what is considered the normal range can lead to an array of side effects, as you've discussed with your own personal experience, which really highlights the importance of having testosterone therapy, normalized testosterone levels within that normal range. So the next steps for you, was that to be on a testosterone gel?
Yeah, so, well, because I had no monitoring during COVID, I just stopped taking the injections. And the way I thought about it is I'd had 50 years of having virtually no testosterone in any case, and I was still alive. So, I probably could manage for a couple more. So I just stopped taking it. So, but as I'm getting a bit older, I'm finding that I'm getting a bit more tired and I have trouble concentrating on things. Within the last couple of years, I've asked my GP for the gel. I've had... I said before that they forgot to monitor me. So that was one issue I had with my GP. He was very reluctant to prescribe me another type of hormone, although it was a difference. I was already prescribed testosterone in any case, but he was very reluctant to prescribe me the gel. And initially, he just gave me like a 3-week supply or something. And got the prescription wrong because he wasn't used to prescribing it. So it took me ages to get it because he wrote the prescription out wrong.
Yeah, and you mentioned demanding the blood work with your own background and experience. Did you find that the doctors and that whole testing procedure was relatively smooth, and that the doctors knew how to interpret the testosterone tests?
When I requested one of these sets of tests, my GP, I give him a list, he goes off and does it. He's good like that. And my results came back, but I phoned the surgery and they said, oh, it's fine. The doctor said, there's nothing to be concerned about. And I said, well, I am a healthcare professional. I'd like to actually know what the figures are. So I got a hard copy of them in those days. I looked at them and they were massively abnormal. And it was because I hadn't taken any testosterone, so it was massively abnormal. And the lab had actually written on them, patient appears to be menopausal, check last menstrual period. So my bloods were so abnormal, they thought A, I was female, and B, I was menopausal. But my doctor had written on them, normal, no action required. And it's a lack of knowledge in primary care. And I sort of understand it because in a GP education program, they might cover these conditions in an afternoon on a 7-year course. There's something they don't think they're going to see very often. They're probably not assessed on it. And that knowledge fades.
Wow. And yeah, that really does beg belief how any doctor could pick up those results and pass it off as normal. And it's a good thing in that example that it was you in that situation, if that makes sense, with your own experience and knowledge to actually demand the results to see for yourself. And if that happened to other patients without your background, then they may not be diagnosed properly and also go on to receive the appropriate treatment. And I think this leads on to my other question for you is that we've discussed that Klinefelter isn't a well-recognized condition in healthcare, but also among the general public. And often disease awareness is so important for patients to actually forthcome to their doctor with any health or symptom concerns. So what resources are available around Klinefelter for patients to learn more about the condition?
Well, I mean, normally in situations like this, we say go and ask your GP, but chances are your GP won't know anything about it. I know I'm down on GPs. I've just had a bad experience myself, and I know a lot of other people have had a bad experience as well. But there's something like 46,000 diagnosed conditions, isn't it? So we can't expect everybody to know everything about every one of them, which is why we have specialists. But because it's such a relatively common thing, so people know about Down syndrome, and that affects something like 1 in 700 people. So Klinefelter's is as common, if not more common. So why don't they know about us? And part of that reason, obviously, Down's is A, much more noticeable, and B, has a much bigger effect on people's lives. But something like Turner syndrome as well, that affects 1 in 2,000 people. But GPs know about that and, you know, treat that. But again, it has, you know, more immediate effect on people's lives. Yeah. So we need more available resources. I mean, obviously, I'm going to plug the Klinefelter Syndrome Association. So we have a website. You can just Google us. It's ks-net.org, I believe. ksa-net.org. And unfortunately, because it's quite specialised, your endocrinologist will know about it. Absolutely. And as I said before, some people do have problems socialising, and we run lots of like a fortnightly online support group. There's Facebook groups you can join. We run activity weekends. We've got a conference coming up in June where we have lots of medical specialists from these clinics in London come and tell people about, you know, what's happening with Klinefelter's and, you know, how they can help people. There is sort of quite a fundamental problem that if you look at because they're trying to keep things simple for kids, if you look at like a GCSE or even an A-level textbook, it'll say men have XY chromosomes, women have XX chromosome. It doesn't tell you there's anything else, and it's this whole nonsense about binary gender and things. But don't stop me on that one. It's everything is a spectrum, and there's lots of variations, and all these variations cause a variety of problems. But people just get this thing stuck in their head that these people don't exist, and we do.
Yeah, that's a really interesting point. And I don't think I've ever kind of considered it like that in terms of the whole education life cycle, especially in GCSE, as you quite rightly mentioned, when you're learning about meiosis and the inheritance of sex chromosomes, there's only two options, right? You never consider that there's something other than XY or XX. When there is, obviously with Klinefelter and other kind of chromosomal conditions. So, it's really important with the work you're doing at Klinefelter Syndrome Association to really continue raising awareness of this condition.
Yeah, absolutely. So have a look on our webpage. It is ksa-uk.net. There is a helpline number on there as well. So if you want to, if you think you have the condition, you need to speak to your GP. And, you know, if you look at our list of symptoms and you think that's me, and if I'd known about KSA before and looked at that website, I'd be thinking, I bet that's me. But, you know, I didn't know about it then. But we do have, a helpline as well. You can email us as well if you want to do it.
Yeah, fantastic. And there's a wealth of resources on the KSA website. And here at Treated, we certainly encourage any patient who wants to learn more about Klinefelter syndrome to visit that. A question we ask all our guests on the Men's Health podcast is if there was one myth you'd like to abolish or destroy in this case in Klinefelter syndrome, What would that be?
Yeah, so this condition was first categorized in the 50s. And unfortunately, the early research was done on a group of people who were in a psychiatric hospital. And they found that lots of people, and I'm not sure if it was a prisoner or a psychiatric hospital, actually, but they found that lots of these people had A, criminal tendencies, and B, had severe learning disabilities. So for a while, that was characterized by what you have. You know, if you've got Klinefelter's, then, you might not be on the straight and narrow, and you certainly have these more severe learning disabilities. But we, like everything else in life, it's a spectrum disorder. So some people are more affected than others. And if you look at the general population, the people, that don't have Klinefelter's, some people have quite severe learning disabilities and other people are, absolutely fine. But what they say now is that we don't think it affects people's intelligence, but some people do have learning difficulties and some people have more higher function problems. So they have poor organizational skills and memory and able to, organize tasks and things. So from that point of view, but it doesn't affect everybody. And this is something we've been, trying to get rid of for a long time. So another sort of aside, when my GP found out I had Klinefelter's, when the hospital told him, he actually marked my notes that I wasn't allowed to see my own notes without a healthcare professional interpreting them for me. But it's just because I had that, just because I had the disorder, he just presumed that I wouldn't be able to, I wouldn't be able to make an informed decision about my healthcare.
Absolutely. I think that's such an important point. I mean, with any spectrum disorder, as you've very eloquently put it, there are people who suffer more severely and others who it doesn't really impact their lives at all. And I think that's a really important point for people to really understand, is that not everybody with Klinefelter syndrome will have the extremities of the symptoms and issues. And a lot of people actually, like yourself, live very normal lives. And on to the final question then for today. This is quite a difficult one with the nature of our discussion, in that it's not a very well understood condition, and in your experience and many others, people have probably been let down by the healthcare system. And what should a man do then if they are concerned they have Klinefelter syndrome?
Oh, absolutely. So if you've listened to this podcast or seen some other resource and you think, probably my testes are a bit on the small side, I've had some problems, just go to your GP, explain, be informed. So know what you're talking about. Go to GP and say, I've got this, I'm a bit concerned about it. Can I have the genetic test? They shouldn't refuse anybody this test if you've got good reason for having it. I have seen or have heard of some much older people who think they've got it, like people in their 80s, who have been refused the test because they say it won't make any difference. But that's not strictly true, because if they're hypergonadal, having testosterone will affect everybody, so that might, will give them a better quality of life.
Absolutely. And Chris, thank you so much for joining us here on the Men's Health Podcast. It's been fantastic to hear your insights and hear you share your own personal experience and story with Klinefelter syndrome. And hopefully this episode has helped raise awareness of Klinefelter syndrome. And if patients or men do have any concerns, they can certainly head to your website to learn more about the condition. So thank you so much. Thank you for listening to the Men's Health Podcast. That's all we have time for today. But do keep an eye out for future episodes as we continue to share lots of resources and new information on men's health issues.
Mental health, obesity,
sexual health,
diabetes.
Supporting men's health and patient care. Building knowledge in men's health communities.